Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Ohio. Thank you very, very much. It is a privilege to be here. I just can't tell you how much of a privilege. It's been a wonderful weekend. Joe, Tom, you know, and it's all the speakers have just been absolutely outstanding. And Sam, something else, Bob. All men, get that. And look at here, all women. I thank Diane for asking me. It's been a real privilege. And to Perry, who I talk to more on the phone, I think, than you, it's really been something. And this signer over here is absolutely special. I mean, good grief. It's amazing. And it amazes me. First of all, I better tell you, my name is Beth Gordon. I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Golden Link group, and they meet on Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. And my sobriety date is March the 5th of 1972, and because of the grace of God and you people and this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink or take anything that makes me more screwy than I am since that time. And for that, I am eternally grateful, very, very grateful. This is quite a way of life, and I'm a little emotional because when I hear things read, and I hear the 12 steps read, and when I see a new person at a meeting or something, I really realize what a privilege it is to have received a gift that was so freely given. I still have a problem with figuring out if I deserve the gift or not, and I don't think so. But I guess in his wisdom, a God of my understanding chose to give me that gift on a very special day of my life, and I just don't ever want to forget it. Because it's allowed me to live, is what it's done. And Alcoholics Anonymous is just that. I was told that from the get-go by my sponsor, who said, this is a way of life. It isn't just going to meetings. It isn't just working as hard as you can on the 12 steps and the four absolutes, which we use back in Ohio. But she said what this is, it's a way of life. It's how you live. And it isn't just happening in meetings, you know. It's how you live when you have to stand in the grocery line and you've got one item and there's 10 baskets in front of you that are filled to the brim and nobody says, oh, my dear, would you care to go through? I want to tell you what I like to do, but then, you know. And it isn't when you're going on the freeway and you're late and you get stuck behind somebody that's going 25 miles an hour having an experience with the abutment and you're late to work. It's every facet of your life and it's a way of life. And she said, and the wonderful part about it is all you need to do is just to stay here. See, nobody's ever told me to keep coming back. They just say, stay here. And so I've stayed here. And she said, all you need to do is to stay here and start on this wonderful adventure that never ends. never, ever ends. There's a lot of changing that goes on. There's a lot of growing. And this takes a long, long time. And it's never ending. And back then I was real smart. And I said, well, someday I'll get there. And she said to me, where's there? You know, you're talking about there with them and those. You know, where's there? And I said, oh, you know, there, when you have it all made. And she said, you never have it all made. You just don't. You don't. It just goes on forever. And there's always something to learn each day. It's an exciting adventure to live each day. And she said, and I'll tell you something. If you take the cotton out of your ears and you shove it in your mouth and you listen and you learn how to hear, why, you're going to go through this wonderful adventure. And smart that I was, I said, oh, someday I'll get there. You know, the day I die, I'll get there. And she said, let me tell you something, Toots. The day you die, you're going to go to the big meeting in the sky. And when you walk through those gates, you're going in as a new person, and you're going to start all over again. So, God bless her. But anyway, I just have a tremendous love affair going with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have since I came in, and it is a lot of change, and that's what that Serenity Prayer has said to me for years, because I was taught that in my early recovery, that it's not anybody else changing, and it's me. And working on me is a 24-hour-a-day experience, I'll tell you that. And I say a little prayer every morning. I use the Serenity Prayer a lot during the day, but I say another prayer during the morning that reminds me that what I do every minute of my life in a day is going to have a bearing on the whole outcome of the big deal when I do go to the big meeting in the sky, and that prayer goes like this. When I was born, I cried and the world rejoiced. And I pray to God that I may live each day so that when I die, I will rejoice and the world will cry. And that's helped me an awful lot. It's the whole ball of wax has helped me. And, you know, it wasn't like this all the time. And it's not that I don't make mistakes. I know I'm the Sunday morning speaker and, you know, see the aura of. And my home group loves this. And, you know, a lot of people here have asked me, are you a nun? Is that why they asked you? Well, in the first place, I'm a Methodist, so I can't be a nun. And in the second place, no, I'm not a nun. I never was a nun. And I don't even think they would have wanted me to be one. But anyway, it tells in the big book, you know, that we said there that we've got to share a little bit about, you know, what it was like, and then what happened, and what it's like today. And once upon a time, I was a little girl that loved to run in the sunshine and chase butterflies, you know, and pick dandelions and go on the end of your nose and get it all yellow, and I'd scare the policeman and that stood at the corner with my yellow nose. And I loved to make angels in the snow, and I love to watch the stars, and I love to have tea with my raggedy underneath a cherry tree in our front yard, and I just love living. And I started in going to kindergarten, and I used to go home in tears because the kids laughed. And my first father was murdered before I was born. He was 24 years old, and it was a direct result of alcohol. And I have my mother, and I really never realized I was different until I started to go to school. And kids can be cruel, and I got laughed at. And plus that, my mother and my grandpa and grandma had come over from Scotland, and I talked funny, because I lived with them and I rolled my R's and I had this very guttural way of talking, and the kids laughed because they couldn't understand me. And I didn't understand that. And so my mother started me in diction school, and she did remarry when I was 9 years old to one of the finest men that I've ever known in my life, and never have thought of him as anything else other than my dad. And so it was kind of crummy, and I figured, well, you know, even with these diction lessons and everything, I felt like I was always standing outside a glass with my nose pressed, trying to peek around and see what was on the inside. And as time went on, and we had a wonderful family, and I could count on my family, and I could talk to my family. And then one day I noticed something, that when the whole family got together, on Easter and Christmas and Thanksgiving, everybody was always so glad to see each other, and then they brought bottles out, and they'd get their glasses and put ice in it, and then they'd dump this stuff from the bottles in their glasses, and everybody would drink it, and then everybody got mad at everybody else and called them terrible names, and all went home, slammed the doors, and nobody ever ate. And I never wanted it to be that way. So coupled with that and the way that I felt, and I never was going to have any of that junk in those bottles, by gosh. I never was going to get mean and icky and ugly like they were. And coupled with all of that, I was pretty unhappy when I went through my childhood. And I wore a mask. You know, I wore a mask till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor said, hey, you don't need to wear a mask anymore. And but I put on a front, and I kind of marched through life, and it was gloomy, and it was icky, and I couldn't see any fun in it at all. And I never smiled. I never smiled till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor said, while you're running around to all these meetings and reading the big book, why don't you smile and give your face something to do so it doesn't feel left out? And I've been smiling ever since. Anyway, I think smiling has a lot to do with your attitude. I feel a lot better when I smile. And I love Hal M. from Washington, D.C., who says an attitude of gratitude, and that's so true today. But anyway, I met Prince Charming. And we went riding off in his 1955 blue Ford into the sunset, and everything was going to be just fine, because now I'd reached the point in my life where I was had all these expectations of the other guy. None of myself, but always of everybody else. And I wasn't happy being married at all. And I married somebody who lives the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and wasn't an alcoholic. And I didn't like it, because I wasn't getting what I wanted when I wanted it. And I didn't like being a mother when my first daughter was born. I just didn't like it. It wasn't what I thought was going to happen, because I had to give of myself, and I wasn't a real good giver back then. And so life was just kind of icky, and I walked on my face, and we were at a party one time, and some guy said, hey, why don't you learn how to smile and laugh, you know? Why don't you loosen up? Why don't you have a drink? And I'm telling you, this arm shot out from this shoulder, and this hand grabbed it, and I forgot all that, my big promise to myself. And I drank this thing. It was a Manhattan on the rocks with a bunch of garbage in it. I'll never forget it. It was, oh, man. And it just was the worst thing I'd ever had in my whole life. I mean, you know when you suck on a lemon, how you get feeling around here? And I gagged when it went down, and my eyes got all teary, and my nose started to run. And I thought for a minute I was going to throw it up. And then something happened. The same thing happened that happened to you. I got warm. I felt wonderful. I felt like I was no longer sticking my nose against that glass, peeking in, that I had arrived. When I talked, you know, everything, my mouth moved, and everything that came out just made sense to me. And then I went to the bathroom, and I washed my hands, and I saw Elizabeth Taylor looking back at me in that mirror, and I knew I was home. I knew I had it made. And from that point on, you know, just like the stories go, I drank, I got drunk, and I got into a lot of trouble. It was, my life was like, I was a little snowball on the top of Mount Everest, and somebody kicked me off. And, man, did I pick up momentum going down the side of that mountain. And very, very briefly, I was a wino. You can be around me 2 minutes, and you know that. I loved wine. I loved what it did. It's like rocket juice. It gets you where you want to go quicker. I loved it all. I loved Thunderbird. I loved Muscatel. I found a guy in the neighborhood who made Mad Dog, and I loved that. I just loved that. And I even loved the gooey junk in the bottom of the bottle. But one thing about Mad Dog is I always had to eat saltines because I kind of got feeling sick. And then I'd get sicker, and I figured it was a saltine, so I switched to Ritz. And, and all that stuff. And I liked wine, too, because it was cheap, it was accessible, and it came in all different sizes. And you could get it into the house, you know, the little pints you could hide down your front, and you didn't make a lump. And you could hide it under your bed easier. And I loved the fifths. I used to paint some of those white and hang them out the window on the second floor because I was expected to do a lot of things like vacuum and dust and do all those little household chores. And I don't know about you, but I never could read what I wrote the night before. When I hid those things, I'd write down where I hid them. And because my memory, for some reason, wasn't all it used to be. But I couldn't read what I wrote. So I figured if I painted them white and I hung them out of the second-story window on the white rope, that when the great thirst came over me when I was hoovering, I could just hang it up like this and take a slug and let it back down. And nobody could see it, I figured, because I went out and checked. Because we have a white house, and I couldn't see it hanging there, painted white against the white house. And that worked for a while. Until he saw it one day and called me down and asked me what it was, and I said I didn't see anything. And so he went to get his best friend Marty that lived down the street, and he told me not to move. You know how they are, don't move, and you promise, I won't move, I won't move, I'll be right back. And he went around the corner of a bush, and boy, I shot up those stairs, and I dragged that thing in and hit it, and ran back downstairs, and I wasn't even breathing hard when I was standing there. And he came back with Marty, and he said, you know, she's going crazy. You see what she's doing? Look it. And he pointed, and Marty looked, and he said, hey, Bruce, maybe you need some help. I don't see anything. Yeah. You know, it's family illness. So, anyway, stuff like that went on, you know, my real favorite place to hide my booze was in the douchebag. Let's see how you handle that one, Deanna. You know, if you hang around this program long enough, once in a while something comes into your life and you don't quite know what to do about it. So anyway, yeah, it was easy. I poured it in there. Nobody looked. You know, hang it up. Could hang it up in the bathroom, and then when I went to the bathroom, all I need to do is take the hose and unclick it. So anyway, anyhow, so it progressed, and finally at the end of 5 years of going through this and forging checks and having a pawnbroker and all this stuff. He said to me, you've got a problem with alcohol and you better go to Alcoholics Anonymous or I'm going to cut off your allowance. And I knew once that was gone, everything was gone. And I wasn't ready to stop drinking. So for the first of three times, I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, for God's sake, listen. I wasn't honest. It was always everybody else's fault. I didn't keep an open mind. I heard your stories and everything, and I heard about your jails and your divorces and all of this stuff. See, that hadn't happened to me yet, and I think yet is like an atomic bomb in this program. Because if you go out there and you do what you did, you're going to get what you got in spades. It's just like that. And I wasn't willing to do what you asked me to do. And a couple of years later, the social service workers had been called because the violence had set in around the home and the children weren't dressed properly. My husband was a sales engineer and traveled, and he was gone quite a bit. And nobody can bird dog, and your kids sure aren't going to talk about stuff when you've threatened them. And one neighbor, God bless her, did rat, and the social service workers said, you know, we're going to take your children away from you. We don't care if you're married or not. And, you know, all my life, since I was that little girl having tea with my raggedy underneath that tree, all I'd ever wanted to do was to be a good wife and a good mother, and it wasn't happening. And I didn't understand what was happening. It was just like my life was just evaporating right in front of my eyes, and I didn't understand why. So I went back around to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to one meeting a week. And, hey, I've never heard of anybody who hangs onto a job that goes once a week to work, you know. And I'm not speaking for AA, but I don't think it can be done. At least I can't do it. And it didn't last very long because I wasn't honest, open-minded, and willing to do anything. And a few years after that, a judge looked at me over a thing like this, and he said 90 days in the workhouse or Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on my ninth DUI, and I was in a terrible assault and battery charge. The Summit County Sheriff had stopped me on one of my little ventures of drinking and driving, and had wanted to take me home, and I got very angry with him, and I hit him over the head with one of my wine bottles, and he got 24 stitches, and I had my picture taken at the Summit County Jail with numbers under my chin, and hey, Tom, I almost made it. Out there, and the next 4 years, you know, were complete hell because I played that same game with AA for a few months, and takes me to March the 4th of 1972, which is a very important date for me, as well as anniversaries, sobriety date, which is March the 5th of 1972. Because on March the 4th of 72, I finished everything there was to drink in the house by 9 o'clock in the morning. And it was the first time that I didn't get that terrible feeling down in the pit of my stomach that, my God, I was going to die if I didn't have anything else. It was the first time in a long time that I didn't drink rubbing alcohol or cologne or that kind of stuff in order to keep me going until I could get to find what I liked the best, the wine. And I sat there at that kitchen table and I knew I was dying. It wasn't because I weighed 64 pounds and my hair was coming out in sheets and I couldn't keep food down and I was bleeding out of my ears and my nose. And my husband said at one point he even thought I was crying blood. And I don't know. But I sat there and I just knew I was dying. And I watched my family go to church and nobody said goodbye. You know, the loneliness of this disease, it was talked about last night, is something terrible. I was living in a home and nobody was talking to me. And I'd go outside every so once in a while, you know, and wave maybe at a neighbor that was going by, and nobody waves back. I don't know anything worse than that terrible loneliness of the alcoholic. And when that door shut, I realized something, that on those faces of those children and my husband walking out that door was everything ugly, everything nasty, all the deception and the guilt and the shame, the dishonesty, the whole bit that goes along with alcoholism. And I knew something, that I'm an alcoholic. And because of my alcoholism, what I had seen on those faces was because of what I was doing. And I wanted to live all of a sudden. I just wanted to live. And I believe that on that day, at that one moment in time, you know, of all the moments that are gone and passed in my life, and of all the moments that are coming towards me, in that particular moment, God, in all His wonderful mercy and His grace, said, "Come on, kid. You've had enough," and handed me the gift of sobriety. And in that one splitting second, that little part of me that still belonged to God, that wasn't chewed alive by alcohol, that I called my soul, opened up, and God in His gift zoomed in. I don't think that'll ever happen again. I'm an alcoholic. I have another drunk coming. But I sure don't have another recovery coming. And I look back at that time and that date as very, very special to me in my recovery. I went to the phone and I called my Aunt Jean, who at that time had 9 years of uninterrupted sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she lived in Chicago. And she asked me the name of an old-timer who had never given up hope on me, and his name's Jerry Jackson, and Jerry died with many years of sobriety in 1978. And Jerry had met me in 1962 when I was fooling around with Alcoholics Anonymous and had kept track of me all those years. And he'd taken a real liking to my family. And he came over and gave my family that kind of hope that we give to each other in these meetings, that kind of hope that we give to each other when we're listening on a phone, that kind of hope that we give to each other over a cup of coffee, the hope that whatever is there will pass. And something wonderful will happen. And, you know, I was cleaning my house, the stuff in the beginning remains real, real important to me today. But I was cleaning my house in the, you know, early out of my sobriety and when I could function. And I whammed the spider web out of the corner in the living room, and this little spider fell down on this invisible thread, and he started to swing back and forth, and I was going to kill him. I put my mouth, I can't stand them. I have tried, I forgive me, but I can't tolerate them. And I watched him hanging on to this little invisible something, and I thought, that's just exactly what we do when the chips are down. We hang on real tight in the hopes that we can climb one step at a time and rebuild what has been destroyed. And in his case, it was his home. And I watched him. I didn't stand there like a nut because it takes him a while. But every time I go through, I take a little peek, and he put one fuzzy foot over the other, and he climbed this invisible something, and he rebuilt what had been destroyed, his home. And it was the most beautiful spider web I've ever seen in my life. You know, when the sunshine would come through the window, it would make colors. And I thought, that's hope. Now, Jerry came over and he said, you know, this isn't easy, Beth, because nothing in life that's worthwhile is easy. But I'll tell you something, if you take our hands and you trudge this road with us, something beautiful will happen. Your life will get better. And I thought better was going to be, you know, that everything that I wanted. And I found out today, That better means that I have the ability to stand myself. I have the ability to either like myself or not. And if I don't, I better do something about it. Because I got to be with me wherever I, you know, wherever I go, there I am. You know, I didn't leave me in Brecksville, Ohio, and come here without me. You know, I kind of came along with. And so I brush my teeth with me. I go to bed with me. I go to the bathroom with me. Everything I do, I'm there. And if I get uncomfortable in here, I know something's going on. And by gosh, I better do something about it. And then they came. The sponsors. Oh, God, pick your own. In the door they came, see? And, you know, they told me everything I never wanted anybody to hear. And all they were doing was sharing their experience, strength, and hope with me. And then they whispered. They get in a corner and they whisper, you know, and they get sick, dying, never saw anything so horrible, you know, all that. And some guy at a meeting one time said, I remember you. The first meeting they brought you to, you looked like olive oil after a shipwreck. So if you're new, keep coming back. There is a little improvement. And Anyhow, they tried some hospitals. There were three in the area. There was Rosary Hall in Cleveland, and they have three detox beds for women, and they had shut down because they were painting the walls pink and hanging up polka dotty curtains or something. And then they called Serenity Hall over in Bayview Hospital, and they didn't take women at all. And then they called St. Thomas Hospital in Akron. And at that time, they had a couple of detox beds for women, and there was four and a half week waiting list on it, and they decided nobody'd ever died on them, and by God, nobody was going to start. So we went to 2 and 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week for the first year I was sober. And they held my coffee cups, and my husband literally had to get me dressed. The first month, I couldn't function. I couldn't operate. And it's in these meeting rooms that I am learning how to live. I remember a lot from those that first year, especially. I remember the openness, and I remember the kindness, and I remember somebody taking my cold hand in their warm one and saying, welcome. I remember the first time I cried. And crying was something that I rarely did when I was drinking. And I remember the first time that the tears poured down my face. I remembered hearing the Serenity Prayer, and I remembering it from somewhere and not knowing it, and opening my mouth and making sounds come out so that you'd think I knew the Serenity Prayer and it would be okay for me to stay. Because I didn't know what I was going to do if you wouldn't let me stay here. I just didn't know. And my sponsor then said to me, hey, you don't need to pretend anymore. This is a place we take our mask off. This is a place you're going to learn who you are and where you're going. And you know, when I say today, my name is Beth Gordon, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, chills go from up here down to under my feet because I know who I am. I'm an alcoholic. And I know where I'm going. I've got a road of sobriety ahead of me, and it's a wonderful adventure, and that's where I'm going. With the help of 12 steps in the grace of God and you guys. I remember this is when she said to me, you got to learn to listen and hear. And when that day comes, you will have heard the Serenity Prayer and you could say it. And I remember the meeting and I remember the day and I remember saying the Serenity Prayer. And I knew something then, that you didn't lie to me, that you weren't using me for an experiment. And if I stayed in these rooms and I did the things that you asked me to do, then I could be okay. And that was real, real important to me. You told me stuff in the beginning that I haven't forgotten. You told me if I ever wanted to go back to social drinking, that I better take a second look at that. And, you know, and I never was a social drinker. I don't know about you guys. Closest I ever came to being a social drinker was when somebody said, I think I'll have another drink, and I said, so shall I, and we got on with it. And, but they said, you know what you're like? You're like a cucumber growing in the garden, and someday some guy comes along and picks you and sticks you in this big, deep, dark barrel of guck, and slams the lid down on you, and you're in there, and there's no time, there's no day, there's no this, there's no that. You're just there. And how long are you there? Days, weeks, months, years? Who knows? And then one day, somebody comes along and lifts the lid on that barrel, and when they take you out, you are no longer a cucumber. You have turned into a pickle. And there is no way, Bethy, that a pickle can ever become a cucumber again. Now go and buy yourself a jar of pickles, stick it in your, you know, shelf in your refrigerator so you can remember that. So, you know, and I still have a jar of pickles sitting right there in my refrigerator. And no, it isn't the first step or the only jar that I've ever had. I bought a new one. I mean, I can afford it. But sometimes I'll look in there and I'll take a look at them and I'll say, what step are you guys on today? You know, if it works, you use it. If it works, you use it. And you know, there was all kinds of stuff like that. You told me it's the first drink that does it to me, not the last. And I had a real difficult time with that until somebody in the meeting said, you know, go on down to the railroad track and sit on it. And when the train comes along and hits you, get up back up off the track and come on back and tell us how you feel. Well, I knew I'd be dead. I couldn't do that. You know, and I said, I'll be dead. I'll be dead when the engine hits me. And the whole room exploded. They said, right on, Toots. It's the engine that kills you, not the caboose. It's the first drink that does something up here over which we have no physical control. And I could understand that. And you taught me how to stay away from that first drink one day at a time. You said you get phone numbers. And people in AA love to give you phone numbers. And you get 25 phone numbers and you stick them up there by your telephone. And I said, well, I have this little book. And they said, that little book is wonderful to carry around in meetings. But they said, I'll tell you something. When you're in your house and something's facing you and your tummy starts to go around and your head is zooming around in circles, how are you going to remember where you put your little book? All you need to do is walk to the phone and start dialing. And my sponsor taught me how to use the phone. I had to call the old battle axe at the same time every day. Not 1 minute earlier. Not, I still have to call her every day. Same time, the old battle axe. I get a reprieve when I go away like this, but I'm going to have to call her right when I get home. And my plane lands at 5:45 in the morning on Monday, and it'll serve her right. That's all I can say. And... but, you know, they say, she said, dial the first number, and then if that guy is on the phone talking to somebody else, when you're trying to reach them, you won't go into that, oh, poor me, you know, poor me one, you know, that thing. You can go on to the next one. And if that person is out living and doesn't answer their phone, you can keep going. Somebody is going to be there, and somebody's going to listen and hear what you're saying, and more important, what you're not saying. And I still have 25 phone numbers right up there by my phone, under my phone at work, under my phone upstairs, you know, because they've changed over the years. But I still have to do this. I have to live the basic same way I did. They said to me, you got to get outside of yourself. Start doing something for somebody else. Send them a card. My sponsor said you could call me up and say, how are you, instead of whining. And she made me read. I had to read Winnie the Pooh before I could read the big book. Because they said there's a character in there by the name of Eeyore. And we don't want you to be like Eeyore. He says everything's pathetic and boo-hoo and weep-weep. And we don't, oh, why should you be like that anymore? So I read that and I had to read The Little Engine That Could, too. And then I was,
Hey, everybody I sponsor reads Winnie the Pooh and the Little Engine That Could just as well as that. It's simple. It's simple. And so they said, you know, and smile. Smile at somebody that's coming towards you, walking on their face. Did you ever do that? Try it. You know, when somebody's come along and they look all booped out and everything else, smile. And watch what happens. I've seen shoulders go back. I've heard people start to whistle. I've even had people say thank you very much. It might be the only thing that they've received. And you know how we are. We can only keep and get what we try to give so freely. And, you know, they told me a lot of other stuff, too, but I don't have time to get into that. They told me to read my big book. And they said you read it 2 pages a day out loud to get it in here, to here, and down into here. I still read my big book 2 pages a day out loud. I'm on my 11th big book because I write in the margins and I underline it and it changes. It's magic. Do you know that anything that can be bothering me, I can open that big book and where my eyes fall, there it is. The answer. It's uncanny the way that works. And I really truly believe that the big book is the greatest love story that I have ever read in my life. Look around this room. Nobody should be here. We should all be dead on street corners, living under bridges, in institutions, and yet here we are on a Sunday morning and we're laughing and we know we have a day ahead of us and the sun is shining and the breeze is blowing and we're alive and we're free. And that's the story of the big book, how a God of our understanding gave the privilege to 2 men just to get together and to go on and write the way we should live on a daily basis. It is truly God-given. It is truly a miracle, and it is truly a love story between a God that saw an awful lot going on in us that nobody else could see. And I love that book. And I still have to read those 2 pages a day out loud. Now, if I take it everywhere I go, if you're embarrassed about taking it because it's Alcoholics Anonymous across the front in white letters and you're so anonymous, you know, get that new little blue thing. It's got Alcoholics Anonymous written blue. Nobody can tell what you're reading. My God, you can read it on the bus. Somebody will think you're reading the latest porno novel. You know, I mean, what the heck difference does it make? It's important. It's important. It's our way of life. And they said to read the 24-hour book 4 times a day out loud to get that thought for the day in here, to here, and down in here. And I still read the 24-hour book 4 times a day out loud. And then, you know, all the rest started to come. They took me down to a duck pond. And they said, what do you see? And I said, ducks. And they said, what are they doing? Well, they were floating along, and they weren't even making a ripple in the water. And what they did was make me get on my knees and stick my feet underneath the water, or stick my face underneath the water then, because they said, we want you to see what's going on underneath, where all that peace and tranquility and quietness is that you see up there. And I did it because I wanted to be sober rather than to be drunk. And when I came up out of that water, they said to me, what did you see? And I said, my gosh, their legs are going around like this. And my sponsor looked right at me and she said, yes. And I'm going to tell you something. If you want what you see on the top of that water, then your little legs are going to have to go around just like this. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we call it action. And she said, if your legs stop like a duck, you're going to sink and you're going to drown. And I've always remembered that, you know. And so the action is a big part of the game. And I was told, and I know today. That's why people stand at doors shaking hands. This is why there's chairmen. This is why there's speakers. This is why there's secretaries and treasurers. This is why people get to meetings early and hang around late and put up chairs and take them down and put up tables and take them down and never be too busy to listen to somebody who calls you on the phone and never be too tired to get up and get out of that house when another alcoholic needs you and calls you. And the 12-step calls, some of them I miss because I miss the first couple. I remember the first one time a sponsor ever took me on. She called up and she said, "We're going out." And I said, "Well, I'm tired. You know, I just got home from a meeting. Where are we going?" She said, "The hand is out and we are responsible. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Hung up the phone. Hung up the phone. So in 10 minutes, I was waiting there, and she pulls in the driveway, and I got in the car, and we went over to this person's home, and we went to the front door, and we knocked, and nobody answered, and I started back to the car, and she said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going back to nobody's home." And she said, "See that window on the second floor? It's open that much. Go into the garage and see if there's an extension ladder." And I said, "That's breaking and entering." And she said, "No, it isn't. She called us. We didn't call her." So I went in there, and I got the thing, and I put it up at the house, and I held it. And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm holding it for you." And she said, "I'm not going up, honey. You're going up." And she handed me the big book, and I'm afraid of heights. You know, and I told her, and she looked right at me, and she said, "When the hand goes up." My God, I'd have gone anywhere to get away from that. So I climbed up there, and she's gone like this, and she got sober, and she's hanging onto the ladder, and I'm climbing up there to the poor, suffering alcoholic. And I went in through the window, and as I did, I caught my foot on the windowsill, and I went flat down on the poor, suffering alcoholic who was lying spread-eagled on the floor, hanging on to her vodka bottle. And I was this far from her face. I didn't know what to say. I never went on one of those things. So I looked at her, and all I said was, "Did you call Alcoholics Anonymous?" She said she stayed sober for out of fear. But we used to do stuff like that. You know, and action is a great part of the game. And then you said to me, as I started on my steps, and my sponsor very graciously took me through, you know, the first few steps, and I went to step meetings, and I went to big book discussions, and I got on that. You know, I got there and I just, I came to believe in you. And God still was not a part of my life because I came to this program not even considering God. Agnostic, I don't care what you call it. But it was suggested to me that before I go to bed at night, I take off my bedroom slippers and I get down on my knees to shove them under there and I say thank you. And I said, "To who and for what?" And you said, "You'll find out who you're talking to. You know, don't push the river. It runs just great by itself. Easy does it, but do it." And then they said in the morning when you wake up and you listen to the sounds of the beginning of a new day, and I thought you guys were horticulturists and botanists. I'd heard you say, "Bloom where you're planted and take time to smell the flowers," and all that kind of stuff. And I couldn't believe my sponsor said, "Did you ever do it?" And I said, "No." She said, "Try it. You might like it." And I heard wind. And I heard rain. And I heard snow. And I heard birdies waking up. And I heard the people breathing in my home life. And I heard creaks and groans of my home. And I figure, I'm still doing it because I figure one day I may hear the sun come up. Try it, you might like it. The only thing I would say to you is that if you hear somebody breathing and you live by yourself, you better dial 911. And then they, she said, and in the morning when you get down on your knees and you're grumbling for your bedroom slippers, tell yourself you're an alcoholic and the problem is you, and ask to make lemonade out of the lemons of life that are bounced your way today, and get up and get on with this thing called living. And I did it because I wanted to be sober, and I found out who I was talking to, and I call him God. Tough, huh? He's never come down and bought me a McDonald's. He has just done for me what I can't do for myself. It comes through you. He talks through you. He had a heart attack 3.5 years ago, and I was at home alone, and I went down the steps on the second floor of the first floor, and I lost my vision, and I laid down. You know, I could feel the terrible pain here and down my arm, and I laid down on the rug in the dining room because I couldn't see, and I thought, I'm going home, and there was no fear. The thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, you lose fear, and I waited for the white light, and one didn't come, and I thought, just my luck, it'll probably be a different color, anyway. And all of a sudden, this voice that sounded just like my father's said to me, go to the phone. And I found myself crawling towards the phone, and I knocked it down, and I dialed 911 the same time I flipped open the sliding glass door so they could get in. And they did all the wonderful paddles and all that. It isn't only with that. It's with everything. You know, I've never seen a junkie God's made. I've never asked him why me. You know, why not me? Because obviously we're not given any more in 24 hours with his grace and this beautiful way of life that can't be handled. It's life. Things aren't all peachy and keen. I was told that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, but they said to me, if you hang around, you know, you'll learn how to smell the roses and you'll forget about the thorns underneath. And God's taught me that too. I pray a lot. I pray in the car. People think I'm nuts because my mouth's going and I'm talking to him next to me. You know, I figure he's sitting there. And he isn't dumb enough to be hanging on to, or sitting on the hood or anything like that. And I always pray for the courage just to meet the day. I ask God to go before me in everything I do. And I ask for his wisdom and try to do the best I can. He's just always right. I have a God can, and it's an old coffee can. I put white paper around it, and I wrote God can on it, and anything I can't come to grips with it, and I'll write it down, and I stick it in the God can, and a funny thing happens. Poof, it's gone. I get on my knees at night and in the morning out of respect. I get on my knees a lot of times, and I can't explain it to you. If you don't believe, you'll come to believe. Alcoholics Anonymous has done many things for me, but the greatest thing of all is that they have introduced me to a God of my understanding. It's the best friend I've got, and that's important. I've even bargained with him. I did once. I told him if he'd go do a Lazarus job on somebody that I loved, that I there was nothing I wouldn't give, and it was just like something shot through my head that said, would you give me your sobriety? And the answer was no. Oh. Because without my sobriety, I won't have a God. Without my sobriety, I won't have life. And I found out at that particular time how important my sobriety really is to me, and how very, very grateful I am to be sober. That getting to know God, I couldn't let go, though. I couldn't let go, and I had to do that fourth step and fifth step. And my sponsor said, hey, did anybody ever do anything, fix anything for you when you were little? And I said, yes, my Scottish grandfather. And she said, give me an instance. And I remembered when my Raggedy and I were having tea, minding our own business underneath that cherry tree. And the dumb dog came and got a hold of her and yanked her apart. I mean, he down one of her button eyes, and her poor old yarny hair was all over the place. And Annie, he took out, you know, her poor belly button, and he ripped two arms off of her, and he tore her dress. And I took this crying to my grandfather and got up on that lap and said, Grandpa, can you fix this? And I remember those blue eyes and that Scottish brogue when he looked at me and he said, Bessie, I cannot fix it until you let go of it. And I released it. And I didn't give him a time limit, and I didn't tell him how to sew anything back on or anything. I had that blind faith of a child. And my sponsor said, this is what's going to help you release the wreckage of your past. And I had a little girl that was a year and a half younger than Annie. Her name was Kimberly, and she had red hair, and she loved to run in the sunshine and chase butterflies. And she got the measles when she was a little over a year and a half. And you had to watch children very carefully back then. Otherwise, they could have very bad convulsions. They could get a lot of things from the measles because there were no shots. And I was in the kitchen one morning, and I had been drinking heavily by 9 o'clock in the morning. And Annie came out to the kitchen, and she tugged on me, and with a little over 3-year-old knowledge, said, "Kimmy's on the floor, Mama." And I told Ann to go away and not bother me. I was busy. And went on with my drinking and pouring my stuff, and Ann was back right away, and she said, "Kimmy is the color of the sky." And I hit Ann, and I said, "I told you not to bother me." And when I got into the living room, the neurosurgeons at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital figure Kimberly had 4 very violent convulsions, and her oxygen had been cut off. And she retrogressed back to a 3.5-week-old baby mentally. And she stayed that way until she died when she was 9 years old. I was able to let go of that because you taught me how. And I was able to forgive myself because you taught me about forgiveness. You taught me that a God of my understanding, knowing fully well what had gone before me, in all those minutes, had chosen with his love and his grace to hand me a gift of life. And they said, if God has forgiven you that much, Beth, to give you a life, a new life, a thrilling life in AA, who are you not to forgive yourself? And I was able to forgive myself. And I used that same forgiveness and that same letting go when I had a little boy, and he lived 8 days, and he died in 1970. He was born an alcoholic. They fed him whiskey out of an eyedropper to keep him alive, and it didn't happen. He died an alcoholic. And I was able to, because his mother drank 9 months around the clock, always knowing everything was going to be better. And it wasn't. And I was able to let go of that the same way. And so with that ability to let go and to clear up the wreckage of my past, you know, and it's a continuation through the steps. And I didn't practice the principles in all my affairs in the beginning. I was a wonderful wife and mother, and I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, all these meetings, and I wasn't drinking. They better watch out what they did or they said, or I may go out and get drunk. And my home group heard about it. Have a home group. I got two. My other one meets on Monday nights. I mean, my God, they know what you're doing and saying, and they're not even around. They come up out of sewer pipes. They hang down from, they come disguised in many ways. And they said to me, you go home and you treat your family the way you treat people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You were the white tornado that tore through that house. They didn't ask for it. And you're the only big book, Beth, they got. And so I went home and I treated them like I treated people in meetings. And I shook their head. I said, hi, I'm Beth, I'm mother. You know, I mean, I didn't even know who they were. I had this big thing and four littles. And I've learned who they were. And very, very briefly, I will say to you, my oldest daughter, Anne, is going to be 40 years old. And she lives in a town near me with three of my six grandchildren. And my grandchildren range in age from 2 to 15. And they have taught me to run in the sunshine and to chase butterflies and to feel the wind in my face and to mush down a dandelion. Lying on the end of mine. I love them, and they always want to come over and see Grandma. And do you know what a blessing that is? Do you know when that phone rang and my granddaughter that's 15 said, Grandma, do you want to come over and meet Herbert that's taking me to the prom? I almost died. What a blessing. What a blessing. And they know about Alcoholics Anonymous, and the older ones have been. And I went over and I met Herbert. Judge ye not. Hi, Herbert. But, you know, it's just one thing. And I see Annie all the time, and I wish you'd pray for her. She's going through a very bad time. They have found some very bad degenerative bone disease in her spinal cord. And she's taken it like a trooper. My daughter Linda is married to a man. And they live in Parma, and his mother is the secretary of one of the AA groups. She has 10 years of uninterrupted sobriety, and we spend a wonderful time together. She has the other three children, and I see her all the time. My son Bruce is a paramedic. He's 34, and he didn't talk to me for the first 3 years I was sober because I'd hurt him badly physically. And I used to walk into a room sober, and he'd leave. And he wouldn't eat dinner. And you know what you said? Don't squish him like a butterfly. You know, just, it's like you got a butterfly there. If he flies away and he doesn't ever come back, you weren't meant to have him. But if he does, then you were meant to have him all the time. But you've got to do the things that you need to do. So I went to his hockey games and his little league games. And after 3 years, on a very warm July day, when he was playing in a championship game, his eyes searched the stands and found mine before he pitched that final ball. And he saluted me with a ball. And after the game was over, he sat down by me and he said, you know, Mom, it doesn't make any difference if we win or we lose as long as you're here. And we're real good friends. He's a wonderful paramedic. He lives around the corner with his wife, and it's delightful. My son John is the baby, and he's 30. And if anybody here is 30 years old or 29, 28, wants to come back to Cleveland with me, very good, very good. We have wonderful AA. I'm a wonderful mother-in-law, I would be. But he still lives at home because he's not married. And he's cute. I don't understand. But anyway, I remember the first time he came home and he walked in the house and he said, I'm hungry. I want some lunch. Because they let school out early and I'd been brought home from a meeting and I got on the phone with my sponsor and I started to cry and I said, my God, he wants lunch. I didn't boil an egg till I was 9 months sober. And all of a sudden this baseball cap and these eyes came up over the counter and he said, I'll teach you how to make lunch. And she heard him. And she said, you've come as a child, let a child lead you. And so he took out the peanut butter and jelly and the bread and he spread peanut butter on this one, he spread jelly on that one and he put them together and he said, that's the sandwich, you make one. And with tears streaming down my face, I made my first sober sandwich while a very little boy patted me on the back and he said, job well done. And that wonderful man that hung in there all those years. We got to know each other. We got to love each other in a very special way. And we walked with each other, and we laughed with each other, and we went to the movies together. And he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 1976, I sat on the end of a bed with 4 years of sobriety, and I heard those horrid words, acute myeloid monocytic leukemia, and my soul split in two. I walked out of that room so lost, and you were there. Somebody said, I just thought I'd drop by and see if you wanted a cup of coffee. You never left us alone. You were there in the good times. You were there when the times got tough. When I couldn't get out to a meeting, you came in with your big books and your 12 and 12s. You came in so that maybe I could get out to a meeting, and you sat and you talked with Bruce, who so dearly loved you. I learned so much courage from that man. He never complained. He never put his needs before ours. And the night before he died, and you talk about powerlessness. And the night before he died, he said to me, do you want to dance? And we put on an old Sinatra record, and I held him up because he's 6 foot tall, and he had gone down to 103. And we swayed back and forth to this old Sinatra music, and he said to me, Beth, I'm going to tell you something that I want you to pass on and that I don't ever want you to forget, that there has never been anything like Alcoholics Anonymous in our lives. It's taught us to love and to appreciate. And he said, not only has it saved your life, but it has saved my life and the lives of our children. And he said, someday, real soon, I'll be able to say thank you to the person who made it all possible. We were with him when he died the next day, and it was real difficult to let go. But you taught me how to let go. And I'm telling you, people, I miss him. I miss him. But you know what? I remember the good times, and I remember his courage that has become my courage, and the great love that he had that's become my love. And what I have to do with that love and that courage is to try to give it to others. He would have wanted that. And, I don't care what happens in your life. I really don't. This is a road that is it's life and it's living. But I want to tell you something. If you do the simple little ditties that are asked of you to do, your whole world will open up, and that happiness, joy, and freedom is right here. It's within reach of us all. There is nothing like this way of life. If I live to be 1,000, I will never be able to repay Alcoholics Anonymous for all it has done for me. It is a beautiful way of life. I'm going to quick read this thing and then we'll go home. This card was given to me on March the 5th of 1995. It says, blessings on your anniversary. It says, dear mother, on your 23rd year, we wanted to say how special we all think you are. We stole from a verse you have always loved and changed some to fit especially you and your sober life. We love you not only for what you are, but for what we are when we are with you. We love you not only for what you are making of yourself, but for what you are making of us. We love you for ignoring the possibilities of the fool in us and for laying a firm hold on the good in us. We love you for closing your eyes to the discords in us and for adding to the music in us by listening to us. We love you for your concern of our needs before yours and for the time you gave to us during Daddy's illness and after his death, and for letting Dad and us be ourselves in those awful times. We love you for adding a ray of sunshine in our lives when darkness is closed in. We love you because you are helping us to make of the lumber of our lives not a tavern but a temple, and of the words of our everyday not a reproach but a song. You have done it by being just yourself. Perhaps, after all, Mother, that's what unconditional love means, what AA means, and what the grace of God is all about. Without this, we wouldn't have found our own lives. And it's signed Annie, Linda, Bruce, John, and the grandchildren. Thank you for this, because I'll tell you, without you, this just never would have been. And now may the road rise to meet you, and the wind be always at your back, and the sun shine warm upon your fields, and the rain fall soft upon your face until we meet again. May God hold you in the palm of his hand in the nows of each day. God bless you. Have a wonderful life.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.